Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Isar Patkin, The Wandering Veil, is a survey of works by Israeli-born, New York-based artist Isar Patkin. The show is currently on display at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts, filling their largest gallery space with works from Patkin's 30-year career. The exhibition is grand and labyrinthian, but also surprisingly intimate. It's rich with personal narrative, political metaphor, and myth. Patkin took me around the exhibition at Mass MoCA last week.
We're standing at the beginning of the show at Mass MoCA. Before we look at the pieces that are contained in the show, can you tell me when you knew you wanted to create art and how you decided what paths to follow?
When I knew, I never wanted to do anything else. So this goes back a long time, but it is a very different story being a child and wanting to make art and turning that into your life vocation. You know, that's two different disciplines.
Tell us about the first piece we're looking at here. It's a Don Quixote.
This is a sculpture in anodized aluminum called Don Quixote Segunda Parte, meaning Don Quixote Part 2. It's pretty much life-size. The story of Don Quixote Part 2 is very interesting because Cervantes wrote Part 1 in 1600, and then in 1614, I think, there was a great demand for Part 2. Another writer, Alfonso Avellaneda, wrote Don Quixote Part 2. So in 1615, Cervantes responds with his Part 2. In that second book of Cervantes, he invents a great meta-literary event where Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, his fictional characters, are holding the real book by the other guy and reading about themselves. So this is where reality and fiction gets blurred. And it's a testimony to the power of narrative to the author.
And what inspired you to create the sculpture in it?
Well, you have to remember in the 80s, at the height of postmodernism, the whole notion of the author, the auteur, was in crisis. Originality was in crisis. Everything was appropriation. So this was a great narrative that I thought would be a big breakthrough in the status quo. Continuing with this theme of fiction and reality overlapping, you know, there's this Maya concept in Hinduism that says the distinction between reality and illusion is an illusion to itself. So what I did here, you start with the Don Quixote with the whole mix-up of characters, authenticity, questions like that. He's looking in the mirror, reading about himself. For this show, I turned the mirror around, so the viewer actually sees themselves in the mirror as they entered. The handle of the mirror is a painter's brush. Here, this piece is called Before the Law Stands a Doorkeeper, and it's a kind of a barn piece, an homage perhaps to Duchamp's Étant donné. In this piece, and also remember when it was made, in direct opposition to both modernisms, what you see is what it is, and postmodernism's sort of ironic stance on it. In these pieces, what you see is not what it is. The everything is something else. There's a fruit basket like an Archimboldo face. The fruit makes a face in the kind of style of Archimboldo. There is a screen painting on which we have a kind of memento mori of two kids holding a puppy that create a big skull. This piece, like most of my other works, was inspired by text. And in this case, Kafka's Before the Law Stands a Doorkeeper. It's a short story about a man who passes by this wall with the concierge and wants to go through the door. And he's told he wants to be admitted to the law. And he's told it's against the law. Second paragraph, he goes back and says, you know, this is it, I'm going to die, can I go through now? And the doorkeeper says to him, well, this door was made for you. It's too late now. So the key to this piece here is this trompe l'oeil key in the corner, a painted key that's hanging on a real nail, which sort of suggests the limits of the imagination. If you want to enter the narrative, you're going to have to use the painted key.
And this is a first very, you know, cursory observation. This piece and everything else I've seen, as, and we'll talk about as we walk through, the style is so different than the sculpture, which is different than the veils, which is different from the shadows over here. How do you know what medium you'll use once you have an idea to pursue something?
I'm a storyteller, and style is just a consequence of whatever the story needs to be. So what's unique about these works, they are narrative, they're storytelling. Everything in the work is a kind of an actor in the theater of that work. So it can be the story of Don Quixote, but the anodized, colorful aluminum is also a character. At one point I discovered that the height of narrative is character development. So how do you develop a character in a still object? It's not like in theater you go from scene to scene, or in a movie where you go from flashback to close-up. The sense of time is depicted in a different way in a still object. So using the materials, what the story is, as you are normally understand a story, and all the elements that are encapsulated in each work are all actors within that narrative, within that story, within that event. Over the years, I developed a cast of characters, and it could be the horse, and it could be Don Quixote, and it could be the bride, it could be the color black, it could be a red dress. And as you go through the show, you will see my characters, my ensemble, a group of actors taking on different roles. And you will see the same character doing something else in another work. So the story is very, very layered that way. And it's not something I could have planned in advance. It's not something planned at all. It's just at a certain point, as opposed to the initial perception people have that my work is very diverse, what I'm seeing here in this show, because it's all together in one room, I'm actually seeing my limitations and my repetitions. And it's a great thing for me, because hopefully after this show I won't have to do it again. So if we continue with that thread of the ensemble characters, which are the works and everything in them, this big Masmoka football field size room, I think it's the biggest in the East Coast, allowed me to stage the work in a narrative that I could only do in a setting like this. So there were a bunch of decisions that had to be made about how you structure something so complex. Yeah. How do you take all these work that appear diverse and put them together into a cohesive theme? One of the first decisions I had was to hang nothing on the walls. So the works are like a procession of objects. By being a procession of objects, they become kind of veils of each other, veils and screens of each other. You walk from one through another to the next. We decided to hang the show on these theatrical movie set-like flats. So you're always entering into the story through the back door, through that kind of privileged back door with the musicians, your friends. You are going into rooms that are full of illusion, but you're coming in from the other side of illusion because you are exposed to its structure before you see it. But once you're in the room, it disappears. Kind of like when a movie starts, you know, the lights go down and you enter into the magic of it. And for me, the magical moment as a child was when they started, in the old-fashioned theaters, when they started to project a movie and the curtain was still there, and then the curtain opened up while the image was unveiling itself, but already on the curtain.
So let's talk about this piece in front of us. What are the characters that make it up?
So this, for me, connects to Don Quixote. Don Quixote in literature is one of the pillars of the Baroque. This is my adaptation of Velázquez' Las Meninas, The Maids of Honor, which is a painting that, in its pictorial space, brought the presence of the viewer into the picture. It was a revolutionary invention, in the same way that Cervantes takes his characters from fiction to reality. This one is from the 80s. It's painted on black rubber curtains. The paint is only on the outer surface of the curtain pleats, and the inside of the pleats are basically this deep, dark space that you could almost put your fingers in, like a Doubting Thomas. Again, it's this tension between the reality and the illusion, the verification of the illusion or the verification of the reality or none. Or I really don't really want to explain it.
Is it difficult to recreate the pleats when you have to move it from wherever it was?
I don't recreate the pleats. It may look like a curtain, but it's a painting. So it has a stretcher on the top, a single piece of wood, which is my stretcher.
Okay.
The curtain is a metaphor and a physical substitution to the canvas. So my canvas is pleated, is three-dimensional. It's a veil in the other rooms that is actually transparent or translucent, but it is a canvas. Now, the presence of the canvas, like I said before, is also an actor in that theater or the meaning of what painting is. What you see on the surface of the pleats is equal in importance to the pleats themselves, to the physicality of the curtain. This was a way of bringing the canvas forward. So it's not something on canvas that makes the canvas disappear. The canvas is as present as the image. Another part of the way the show ended up being constructed started out intuitively, and after I built up the floor plan, I realized that I had done something subconsciously that had its own sort of narrative logic. So the section until now are mostly early works that have to do with the mirror, mm-hmm. and with entering the pictorial space. Now we're entering the pictorial space because these rooms, these veil rooms, which are I have five of.
And they're made of the film flats, the theater flats that you mentioned before.
Right, they're hanging on the film flats. But they're paintings on tulle veils. Tulle is actually the French word for this kind of bridal netting, which in the trade here is called illusion. It's like champagne and cava. You know, if it comes from Spain, it's cava. So if it comes from America, it's illusion. And how incredible it is to paint on illusion. Normally, when I do the labels too, I don't do it. I just list the materials. I don't do like paint on illusion or ink on illusion. It's just ink, comma, illusion. So everything is an equal player. So this is, what should we call it? Sequence, cycle of works came out of a deep friendship and a collaboration with a great Kashmiri poet named Agha Shahid Ali. We were invited by a wonderful philanthropist, book publisher in San Francisco to do a book together of his work, sort of parallel to mine. When we met, it was clear to us that the book was going to be the launching pad for a lot more. We decided to call our project Veiled Threats because we decided that the Jew and the Muslim would meet on the veil, and the veil became both a metaphoric and a physical place. In this show, we have five rooms that are based on Shahid's poems. Some are poems that he wrote himself. Some are poems that he adapted from other poets. And there is one room poem called The Veil Suite, which he wrote specifically for a project. And this was the last poem he wrote in his life before he passed away. He had brain cancer. It's a masterpiece.
We're speaking with Isar Patkin about The Wandering Veil, an exhibition currently on display in the galleries at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts. How do you actually make this art? What is the process for physically creating it, for putting the paint on the illusion?
I had a Korean engineer invent a very special printing machine for me that can print on three-dimensional material. It's a reverse technology. Instead of the printer standing still and the paper or the canvas moving on giant rolls below it. Mm-hmm. We reverse the technology, and this printer goes up and down a 14-foot scaffold and can print on the veils as they are, meaning I hang them with their pleats and volumes intact, and it prints right into the layered pleats of the tool. It would be impossible to recreate the position of the pleats otherwise. So in fact, without this printer, these paintings would not be possible. This is a portrait of my uncle, Izar Patkin. I was named after him. He died when he was a young man in the military. And after he died, my grandmother commissioned a posthumous portrait. I think it must have been from an identity card or something. And that was the only painting hanging in her house. And that was the only painting I knew as a child. So this was the first painting in my life. And so it's not like Van Gogh's Sunflowers, or poster of it, I mean. Strangely enough, the two pictures that my mother hung in my room, in our house, well, one was the Potato Eaters, and the second was Degas' Ballerina. So I think maybe that's like the entire show in a nutshell here, right? Something like Potato Eaters in tutus. I decided to make my version of that painting on this window screen, hovering, the paint hovering on the screen like a ghost. Here you are, like the first painting in my life is a painting of my ghost. And somehow that connects to so many things in the show. I decided to put it kind of like in a secret corner, and it would be easy to miss it, but that's kind of how it should be.
It is hanging on the back of one of the flats.
So here we're still in the calamity section. My dead uncle, the wars, the conflict, that crazy part of the world that came from. And you know, the birth of Israel coincides with modernism. It's one of the big stories within modernism, and modernism was a kind of euphoria. Well, I come to New York, and I'm at the tail end of that. And the AIDS crisis starts, and New York is beginning to develop all signs of calamity. This is a painting I made in 1981. It's called The Unveiling of a Modern Chastity, the chastity being the euphoria, the innocence. And it's made out of rubber wounds. It looks like an Yves Klein painting, maybe, that festered with wounds. Something from behind is coming through, but it's still so much about the presence of the surface as well. This is just at the beginning of the AIDS crisis, and it was a pretty terrifying painting, and I have never shown it. This is the first time it's ever been seen in public. I didn't feel the need to show it. It was very personal. But also, in a few times when the subject of showing it came up, it was a bit unnerving, and we dropped it. Here, it's in a room facing another calamity, both personal and public. It's a portrait of my father sitting in front of the World Trade Center. And he visited me in New York. I think this snapshot of him sitting in front of the towers was taken just a few days before the towers were destroyed. Also, my father passed away a couple of months later. So these two things united in my psyche somehow. And this is the first big veil painting that I printed with my big printer. It was a very, very difficult and emotional moment to see the image of my father appearing on the veil like a ghost. And actually, I was working with Ivan, my assistant at the time, and I had to leave the room. I couldn't, I had to walk away from it. And I was saying, what are you doing? You know, it's like playing God here. But then, you know, you get used to everything. So I mean, I got used to the painting, not to playing God. This room is called Violins. Shahid made an adaptation at the behest of Edward Said of a Mahmoud Darwish poem called, and he called it Violins. Mahmoud Darwish is the national Palestinian poet. In the poem, the word violins repeats so many times, like violins, 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 violins. It turns phonetically to violins. For each one of these veil rooms, I was set out to do not a one-to-one literal interpretation or illustration of Shahid's words, but I wanted to create a moment that would be a moment of the poem or a Shahid moment. If you knew the work enough and you would walk in there, the images on the walls are not necessarily images from the poem itself. The task here was to do something parallel to the transition, the phonetic transition from violins to violins. So what I did, I took the famous picture of Pablo Casals playing at the White House in front of the Kennedys, playing his cello. Mm-hmm. And you know, he used to say about his cello, "My cello is my weapon." I put the image of the White House concert on one wall, and then on the wall adjacent to it, I put Pablo Casals, but I turned him around, so he is standing with his back to the audience, meaning he's looking at the world from their point of view. And all together, they're sitting or standing at the White House, looking at another theater. And this time, it's the theater of war. When I first heard the word theater of war, I think it was during the Gulf War, I thought they must be kidding. But then I realized it was a military term. So it was fascinating to me. So they're sitting in the White House, and you see these scenes of calamity, an army coming through this burnt garden, maybe the Tuileries in Paris. The armies are chasing a wagon of gypsies or refugees. I turned the scale up on the wagon with the horses, so the horses almost got like this mythical grand scale, and they're charging back right into the White House. On the wall facing it is a scene of a guy who just lost his horse, and the horse is laying on the floor, and the guy is standing between the horse's, the dead horse's legs. This is the Veil Suite. This is the poem that Shahid wrote before he died. And it's his requiem. And it's really, really masterful. In the beginning, it was called the Veil Suite because we were thinking of the veil as an object that doesn't hide anything, because the image is on the veil, there's nothing behind. But in the very end, he changed his mind, and he changed the title of his poem to The Veiled Suite. But I kept the title of my painting without the ED past tense, without it being something that hides anything. I don't know, maybe I'll change my mind before I die, but so far. So the poem was written in the form of the canzon, which is one of the most complex forms of poetry. And very, very few people wrote one canzone, not to mention two. This was Shahid's third. Wow. And now I'm going to bastardize the poem, just for the sake of communicating the story. It starts with a kind of a quote from a Sufi proverb that says, "Make me now your veil and see if you can hide yourself from me." So Shahid dies. He goes up to see the faceless. The metaphor for uniting with your maker is you become kind of God's bride. Well, God wants to see his bride, so he wants to lift the veil. But Shahid is the veil, so there's nothing to see, so he turns the tables. Mm-hmm. He becomes the faceless. The whole poem for me is a condemnation of the delusion of divine love. He basically blames God for abandoning him or us, which he says is what lovers do. They leave you. That's what they know how to do. In one part of the poem, he kind of asks God, if he says, you know, this is my last night, will you stay with me? But the answer is no. However, Shahid gets the last word, because heartache is the single source of all great poetry. So he turns veil to prevail. And I don't know, it's mesmerizing. Because that's not what the monotheistic God does. He leaves you. He's the one that is invisible, that is not present in any material terms. In fact, the reason this story is so important is because for an artist, for a visual painter or sculptor, but primarily a painter who's involved with pictorial space, there are three options: abstract, representation, or the third option, which is manifestation. So in each one of these options, visually, are linked to deep religious vocabulary. Abstraction would come from the invisible God. And the exact opposite of it would be the pagan God, which is always present. The statue is the God. The meaning is in the statue. And in between, we have all of great Western art, which is a representation, which is kind of a Christian invention, where God is incarnated in the image of Christ. The icon is not an idol, because it's only a representation. But there's a kink to that, because the icon, which is just a representation, is also the only true icon, like the veil of Turin, the Veronica veil. Veronica means vera icona. So you're not driving a car, you're driving a Mercedes. It's like the first sort of one-on-one branding. And in the first time of history, an image delivers salvation. And this is the culture in which we live now. We live in an iconic economy that doesn't work without images. And those images are the promise, which will never be fulfilled. So go buy another Prada dress, and you will still not look like that 13-year-old girl who modeled it. And the process is a perpetuum mobilum. It doesn't stop. It feeds on itself. And we are in this vortex.
Isar Patkin, The Wandering Veil, will be on view at Mass MoCA in North Adams, Massachusetts through September 1st. The opening reception is this Saturday, January 18th, and there will be an artist talk, Isar Patkin with David Ross, at 2 p.m. More information is available online at wamc.org/roundtable, where you may also hear Isar Patkin speak about two more pieces in the exhibition. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.